Welcome to the New Zealand Foreign Trust Podcast with Kate Weiss, brought to you by Asia City Trust New Zealand Limited.
Welcome to episode 2 of the New Zealand Foreign Trust. My name's Kate Weiss, Managing Director of Asia City Trust New Zealand Limited. And today we're here to talk about New Zealand on the global stage. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome back Henry Brandsgeeson of Dentons. Welcome back, Henry.
Thank you, Kate.
Both Henry and I are available on LinkedIn. I work for Asia City Trust New Zealand Limited, and Henry is a partner at Dentons.
Thanks, Kate. It's good to collaborate with you on this project. Obviously, as a partner in Dentons, I'm involved in the design of strategies for international wealth structuring, and it's always important to and valuable for us to have trusted intermediaries such as Asia City who can help execute and administer and govern the structures that we design.
Today, I want to do a deeper dive into some of the advantages that you set out in your basic guide to selecting a trust jurisdiction, which you published in September this year. And one of the things you talk about that is one of the reasons to choose a offshore jurisdiction is tax optimization. Mm. When I am asked by clients as to how to choose a jurisdiction, I say to them, you want to choose a jurisdiction which is sustainable, not just for now, but for the future. And you want to choose a jurisdiction that's going to bring to you the least legal and regulatory intervention going forward. Mm. So when we discuss tax, there's lots of things we can discuss. When we talked in the last episode about midshore, offshore, onshore, you touched a little bit about levelling the playing field. Mm-hmm. And one thing that is really, I think, when it comes to tax, that's unique in New Zealand is the foreign trust disclosure regime. So in New Zealand, like in most offshore, midshore jurisdictions, there's a foreign trust tax exemption. Mm-hmm. In order to get that in New Zealand, we have to jump through several hoops, mm-hmm. which, in my experience, no other jurisdiction has to do. So we have to submit information to the Inland Revenue Department each year, which is related to the settler, the protector, and give enough information which allows the, the Commissioner of the Inland Revenue, thanks Henry, to identify the class of beneficiaries. We have to keep that information up to date. We also have to provide financial statements within 6 months of the end of the financial year. And that needs to be given to the tax authority. And that's how we get our tax exemption. Mm-hmm. In my experience, all the other offshore and midshore jurisdictions, you just have to have non-resident beneficiaries and settlors. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any other jurisdictions that have this obligation that we have in New Zealand?
No, I'm not. And it probably does make New Zealand an outlier in that sense. The perception probably is also it's intrusive, although I would say it actually goes no further or not much further than the common reporting standard does require anyway. And I don't think it's necessarily an issue or a problem or a reason not to use New Zealand. On the contrary, it, I think undoubtedly, legitimizes the industry in New Zealand because of that scrutiny. And you know, perhaps on the broader point of tax, I think it's important to note that almost never nowadays in my professional career are the structures set up specifically for tax reasons. Certainly in the past, historically, tax was a really important factor. People wanted to extract wealth from onshore and put it offshore in a place where income and capital gains could be rolled up tax-free. That happened 50 years ago. But nowadays, that's not a reason for using an offshore jurisdiction or for cross-border wealth structuring generally. But what is important, why tax is still important, is for neutrality. So profits are always paid at source, wherever they're made. But what's important for cross-border wealth structuring is for there to be a neutral venue, a neutral place, a neutral vehicle where profits or capital, for that matter, businesses, other assets can be held in a tax neutral environment. So then you at least take out the need for compliance in that neutral, reporting and registration in that neutral environment so that those profits can then be deployed back into the markets. Yeah. And so New Zealand provides that through the historical tax exemption. And now with the Common Reporting Standard, to which New Zealand is a signatory, and FATCA again, and through this reporting obligation, this internal reporting obligation to the Inland Revenue Department, we've sort of taken out any opportunity, I think, for misuse of the structure. So that's the reason that the registration requirement exists.
I'll come back on to the registration requirement, but I just wanted to talk about neutrality. So there is an index called the International Tax Competitive Index, which seeks to measure the extent to which a country's tax system adheres to two important aspects of tax policy, competitiveness and neutrality. Mm-hmm. So this index has placed New Zealand third in the world out of all OECD countries. Mm-hmm. So Estonia's first, Latvia's second, and New Zealand's third. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for a country or a jurisdiction where neutrality is key, out of all the offshore and midshore jurisdictions, New Zealand's going to be the one that you're looking for. So the next offshore or midshore jurisdiction is going to be United States, if you're looking at the Wyoming, Delaware kind of countries. So this International Tax Competitive Index looks at 40 different factors to determine this. So it's not only the level of tax, but also how taxes are structured. Mm. And I think that's a really important thing to look at, as you say, with regards to neutrality. So I just wanted to come back to the Foreign Trust Disclosure Network. And I think we can tie it into what the OECD is looking for. So it introduced CRS off the back of FATCA. It introduced BEPS for the profit erosion that it was seeing, exactly what you said about tax neutrality. It then introduced economic substance. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing now, and I don't know if you're aware of this, the British Virgin Islands has said that in order to get your economic substance by the 30th of September, you had to upload your financial statements. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing other countries around the world, not at a trust level, but at a company level, having to upload their financial statements. Yeah. But if you look at the environment that you upload it in New Zealand, you upload it straight to the Inland Revenue Department. Mm. And in the BVI, you upload it to BOSS. Mm. And I don't know how much you remember about BOSS and the BVI, but that all registered agents and registered officers have access to, whereas IRD, only the IRD has access to. And I think that's the situation. We talked about levelling the playing field. If to get access to economic substance, you have to upload your financial statements, it is going to become a level playing field. Because as you said in the previous episode, the Caribbean, the offshore jurisdictions, are the forerunner of implementing OECD requirements. And economic substance, the BVI, definitely was the forerunner. So if you're going to see all of the British Overseas Territories requiring financial statements to be uploaded to get economic substance, you're going to see all these offshore companies uploading financial statements. Then the fact that New Zealand's had a regime in place for 8 years, which is tight, which is safe, which is robust because it's been a while, we are going to have this level playing field.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, history shows that the international finance centres that have responded rapidly and responsibly and proportionately to the requirements imposed by the OECD have enjoyed more success probably than even they did before regulation, because they've legitimised their industries and they have made them more sustainable. Now, there is a trend which has been continuing, I think, for some time, probably started almost back with the EU Savings Directive in the mid-2000s, towards greater transparency in these structures. One of the benefits and one of the reasons for structuring outside your own country is to enjoy some privacy. And now that privacy historically has been abused, but there's also really good reasons for privacy too. So there's another podcast again on the debate between privacy and transparency. But the reality is, over the last decade or so, we've been moving towards transparency in both business and now towards private structuring. So in New Zealand, by imposing this disclosure requirement in order to get the tax legislation, I don't think that makes New Zealand necessarily as big an outlier as perhaps I might have suggested. Even in the UK now, you've got registers of trusts, registers of beneficial ownership, which are being rolled out around the world. This is effectively a register of beneficial ownership. But the key thing with these registers is the distinction between public registers and private registers. Now, every responsible jurisdiction, trust jurisdiction I know of, has a requirement on the trustee to maintain their own register of beneficial ownership. And that trustee must maintain that. And when the regulator, or if the regulator comes in to inspect, then that must be up to date. And in fact, those trust companies are audited, I think annually in many cases, and those registers are reviewed. So again, it's not entirely different to other jurisdictions or the offshore jurisdictions that require those service providers to have those registers. It's a bit like the UK system of the Register of Trusts, but in New Zealand we have the information is held by the IRD, so it's just a sort of a different government department, I suppose. But crucially, that information is private. It can only be used by the IRD, and it can't be accessed by the public.
Yeah, I think that is really crucial. Just, sorry, a funny aside on the EU Savings Directive. We're looking at 20 years ago. I'm a junior tax and trust officer, and we had a help desk for all the partners in the when I worked for a wealth management firm. There's 1,000-odd partners, and everyone was off sick, and there was the director and me, and the director was not going to answer this help desk. So he sat beside me, and there was about 9 people out, and somebody phoned up, and I was a junior in tax and trust, so I had my law degree, I had everything behind me. I knew nothing really about tax. I knew about trust. And the person phoned up and asked a question on the EU Savings Directive, and I knew nothing. And literally, the director was next to me reading something on the EU Savings Directive. So I said it out loud, and he put the document in front of me. And I was answering this guy's questions just by reading about the EU Savings Directive. So that was 2005. So that is a while ago. So, yeah, sorry, that just reminded me of that. So I wanted to talk to you about, also going back about 20 years, we were talking about the beginning of our careers. When I first entered into wealth management, we were talking then about the difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance. And back then, avoidance was completely fine. In fact, we did marketing on tax avoidance strategies. Now, if we try to market on a tax avoidance strategy, we would be hung. Now we're talking, as you were saying, about tax neutrality and tax, even tax mitigation is not something we would even look at. And I learned 20 years ago never to market on tax, because tax changes so quickly. And if you ever set up a trust to avoid or mitigate the impact of tax, you're never going to be happy for longer than 2-3 years because of the rate at which tax laws change. And there's so many other brilliant attributes to the trust that you're going to be happy on that. But what is the difference between tax neutrality and this idea of tax avoidance, evasion, mitigation, optimization, whatever we wanted to call it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting observation of how times have changed. There's a famous court case from England and Wales relating to the Duke of Westminster. I forget the year of that judgment, but it was certainly prior to the Second World War, possibly. And in that judgment, the judge says that, to the effect that every person has I think he used the word man, but every person has the right to organise their affairs in such a way that it causes their profits to be taxed, you know, at the lowest rate legally possible, or something along those lines. So back then, tax evasion or avoidance was more of a sport than a crime. And certainly you saw that's how many countries, Switzerland and the offshore jurisdictions, it's how they became prosperous nations, was by providing, I suppose, safe harbours in the world of commerce that was going on around them between other countries, where ships could dock and cargo could be unloaded and it could be held in a place where there was no tax on that profit. on the premise that with the license of the people in those countries, because they figured, well, there's no reason for us to tax it because that cargo wasn't created here, and then it would be then transported to another part of the world, and there'd be no imposition for tax in between. Now that had the benefit of facilitating trade in a really efficient way, because you didn't have excise duties and you didn't have import duties and things like that. You could move cargo from place to place without worrying about all of that stuff. And it attracted business to those places, legitimate business, but it also attracted some illegitimate business, and it also set those created opportunities for people to extract profit from other countries without being taxed. Now that activity, again, up until not that long ago, was often tacitly approved or ignored by governments, and many businesses, legitimate businesses that we all know and still exist today, were doing that sort of work on an industrial scale. But then over time, I think values changed, perceptions changed. I think it became more apparent that tax evasion wasn't a victimless crime. I think probably at a minor level it possibly was, but certainly when done at an industrial scale, there are genuine victims to tax evasion. So, and also there was the related issue of, you know, illegality in terms of narcotics and other goods that were being the trade was being facilitated in those places. So tax evasion became a crime. It became a predicate offence to money laundering, and that happened in the late 80s, early 90s, up towards early 2000s, perhaps in some other countries. And people started taking tax evasion a lot more seriously. So, and what I mean by tax evasion is basically failing to declare profits earned on business, or hiding transactions deliberately with the intent to avoid paying tax. Now, tax avoidance was seen as something quite different. It was basically looking at the law. So in tax evasion, you don't look at the law. The law is kind of disregarded. But with tax avoidance, you sort of look at the law and say, well, how can I manipulate this to reduce the amount of tax that I need to pay? Now, that was far more tolerated than tax evasion, until what happened is, again, people looked at that sort of activity and said, well, that's morally wrong, if not legally wrong.
It's that loophole type thing.
Yeah, looking at loopholes and basically deliberately organising transactions or structuring affairs in such a way as to take them outside of those laws. Now, again, society's perceptions of that activity changed, especially when it's done at an industrial scale.
Yeah.
And, I mean, to be honest, we're all, to some extent, we practice tax avoidance, right? We go through duty free, and we look at the big bottles there for sort of half the price of what you normally pay, and that's because there's no duty on them, there's no excise, right? And we all pick those up and we take one to the counter, and in doing so, we've avoided tax.
Yes.
But of course, that's not done at an industrial scale. It's done in a very small way and doesn't harm society like it does when it's done, or how it can be done. So that's the problem with tax avoidance, and that has an ongoing effect on social services and impacts on real people.
Yeah.
So in response to that, what governments did is they enacted what are called general anti-avoidance provisions in their tax laws, which basically criminalised, or if not in a criminal sense, certainly in a civil sense, penalised that type of activity. And so that's what tax avoidance is. Now, if we talk about tax neutrality, that's another matter altogether. And there's nothing wrong with a country setting up a neutral venue for business activities for capital to pool, for transactions to happen. And that happens all over the world, both onshore and offshore. Any country in the world which has exemptions for fund managers or lower tax rates for carried interest on private equity deals happens all over the world. Just about every country I know of will have certain incentives for business which will involve neutralizing the tax associated with that economic activity. And that's entirely legitimate, and it is, indeed it's a sovereign right of every nation to pass laws to enable that activity. And what happens is economic activity is then attracted to those nations and this goes on in those nations. But that's not to say that no tax is paid. Tax is not avoided altogether. What's avoided is double or triple or quadruple taxation. The tax will always be paid, or should always be paid, on profits wherever they're made. But it's just that when the capital is then moved to a neutral venue, it's then business can be done with confidence, and investors can meet there with confidence, knowing that they're not going to have to account for their another layer, another entity in the transaction chain.
So when we're looking at a jurisdiction or choosing a jurisdiction, and we're saying to clients, you need to look at tax optimization. The first thing of that is the tax neutrality. You want to ensure that there's an exemption for the trust itself in the country that you choose for the trustees to be, so that there's no taxation. So for example, you wouldn't choose the UK for your trustee to be in, because they're going to be charged at the highest rate of tax if the trustees are resident there. Plus, you're going to be taxed where the settlor is, maybe, and you might be taxed where the beneficiary is. The second thing to look at is you want the country to be known for having a robust framework around taxation, so that it's not going to open you up in your home jurisdiction to investigation. So not picking on anyone, but if you set up a trust in New Zealand, you're less likely to have an investigation in your home jurisdiction than if you have a trustee in a known tax haven. Or, for example, if you're setting up a bank account, if your trustee is based in New Zealand, or you go for a trust in a known tax haven, the bank is more likely to open up a bank account because the trustee is in New Zealand. Because when we looked at the tax neutrality statistics, New Zealand is, you know, known for its tax competitiveness and its tax neutrality. That's the kind of point I'm trying to make when it comes to choosing a jurisdiction.
That's been certainly in the last 15 or 20 years, the attraction of a mid-shore jurisdiction over an offshore jurisdiction. Now, to a large extent, I think that perception is unfair on offshore jurisdictions because, as I've said before, they were typically first movers in all the regulatory obligations imposed on them. But the reality is that it is can be very challenging to open up accounts and to deal with third parties using a traditional offshore structure. And so as a result, there is an attraction towards mid-shore jurisdictions like New Zealand.
I think there has to be a distinction between offshore and tax haven, though.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that the term tax haven really means anything, because I think every country, as I've said before, will provide a haven for business that they want to attract. And commonly they do that by providing some sort of tax incentive. So I think the term tax haven is now outdated, to be honest.
Okay. So the next thing in your paper about choosing a offshore jurisdiction is enhanced privacy. Now, I think I've totally misunderstood what you mean by enhanced privacy. So what is it that you mean by enhanced privacy?
Well, I suppose what I mean is historically privacy has been a reason for structuring offshore, because most onshore jurisdictions, their companies' registers are open to the public. You can go onto the company's office or company's house, depending on where you are in the world, and which is an online portal, and you can see who the directors are. You can often see where they live. You can see who the shareholders are and what documents have been filed in relation to that company. Now, many would say, well, that's important and valuable and necessary to a well-functioning civil society and protective of people dealing with those companies from the issues that may be internal to those companies. But for others, that's also an imposition of privacy. And for many companies, the ones that are especially those that are not dealing with the public, those that are holding an asset like a yacht or some real estate, which is just passive, there's a good reason, I think, or justification for the ownership and the control of those companies being kept private. And so that's why some jurisdictions more than others protect that privacy better. And another way to maintain that privacy, of course, is to use trusts to hold the assets, because trusts aren't typically registered anywhere. And where they are, or where there is a beneficial ownership register in those jurisdictions, then that is typically not publicly searchable. But I think there are really good reasons. I mean, privacy is a basic human right. Obviously, it can and is abused by tax evaders and money launderers and criminal elements, but it's also a basic human right and the cornerstone of many societies. So I think it's not fair to say, if you're doing something in private, then it must be dodgy. And particularly in an age now, an era now, where privacy is really under threat with all the data that's gathered by governments and by businesses on our personal lives, I think it's probably now more important than ever that we guard what little privacy we have left.
So when you say enhanced privacy, are there different trust jurisdictions which protect the privacy of people better?
Yeah, there are. Yeah. So, I mean, as a general rule, English common law trusts, which have been transposed and adapted all over the world, or at least much of the world, do by their very nature provide privacy, because they separate legal and beneficial ownership. And the legal owners, the people that are registered on the titles to the property or to that do the business with third parties, they are different from the people that benefit from the structure. So that in itself provides some privacy. The other thing that trusts do is they impose an obligation on the trustees to only act in accordance with the best interests of the beneficiaries. And in many cases, that will require them to protect information about the trust, not to publish financial statements, for example, or give them to third parties. So that exists in English common law and has been transposed just about into every trust jurisdiction in the world. But there are some jurisdictions we've gone a step further. For example, the Cook Islands has criminalised the disclosure of information relating to a trust to a third party. And then I suppose parallel to the protection of information relating to trusts, we have the protection of data just in general society. And some countries, many countries, particularly the more developed ones, have got very strict privacy laws as well, which relate not so much to trusts, but they are relevant to the data that is often gathered during a lifetime of a trust by service providers like passports and utility bills and other things like that. So I think having both a strong governing law that respects the common law privacy, but also a broader statutory legal framework for the protection of data is something that I consider when I'm helping clients select jurisdictions.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is checking out that there is a Privacy Act that protects people's personal information is really important, and not just assuming that people have privacy law. I was really interested when I was looking into this. New Zealand does have a Privacy Act. It's broadly similar to that in Europe, and that there is compulsory data breach notification and data sovereignty. I was really surprised in the United States of America, there is no federal Privacy Act. And you have to go to each state to see if there are personal data which binds companies. So the US federal privacy rules only regulate how state agencies deal with personal data. So you have to go to each state to see if there's a local law that deals with personal data. So Delaware and Florida each have their own personal data privacy acts, but states like Wyoming and Dakota don't. So if you have trusts in Delaware and Florida and have given your personal information, or banks even, there's no act which covers the way that they can process your data, so they can sell your information. But the other thing I think is really important is the cultural mindset of the people who are administering your trusts. And I think this, I previously worked in Switzerland, who are very proud of the way that they deal with secrecy and privacy. And you are trained when you work there. But one thing here, moving to New Zealand, that shocked me is the name suppression, which comes around court cases, in that there's not the salacious details that you get in the papers back in Europe or in the States or in England, that in most criminal and civil matters, there's this interim or permanent name suppression. And there is some public interest stories, but there's not this overwhelming need for the press to find out. And people just generally aren't interested in the names of who has done what and in the lives of the people. And we've had a joint case where we had an American come over here who was a public figure who was obsessed with privacy and wanted companies to literally have utility names, bills in the name of, because he was so worried about his privacy. And I think that's the other thing with regards to New Zealanders, is this overwhelming need for privacy is culturally not necessary here, but it is really necessary for clients around the world.
Yeah, I think it depends on the individuals. Everybody has a different view on how important it is, and that will be determined often by the scale of their wealth, the way they've earned that wealth, and where they live. And probably in New Zealand, we're a little bit relaxed about it because we live in a fairly benign environments, relatively speaking. But certainly you deal with clients in Latin America, for example, and I've dealt with clients in Africa and more volatile parts of the world. It's really, really important to some of them that there is an ability for them to keep their information about their wealth private, because if they don't, they or their family members will be at risk from nefarious influences who will use that information to extract money or influence from them. So I think it's easy for us to be sort of naive in New Zealand, but certainly globally, I think we need to be protecting rights to privacy very carefully, because it's certainly not fair to just assume that if somebody wants their affairs kept private, they're doing something they shouldn't be doing.
No, I think that's a really, really valid point. Okay, so Henry, going back to your paper that you published in September this year, you talk about asset protection being one of the criteria on which to select a jurisdiction. The trust itself is an amazing vehicle which allows for asset protection, but why is it something that would help you to choose which jurisdiction to set your trust up in?
Well, again, it depends a lot on the circumstances and the objectives. And for many people, asset protection won't be such a significant consideration. But for a lot of people, it is. And this is because they live in unstable countries where land or assets or cash could be appropriated. It could be because they're involved in a high-risk industry, which could lead them to be personally liable as a director of a limited liability company, or it could be because they want to protect their family wealth from the breakup of relationships within their families, perhaps their children or something like that. So there's a whole bunch of reasons, a whole bunch of risks to private wealth. We could go on, again, do a whole session on risks. And the risks of private wealth today are much the same as have always been. And the techniques used really to mitigate those risks are much the same as they've always been. I mean, one technique is to just divest yourself of ownership, whether you give that to a trusted third party on a sort of informal basis, which of course has its risks, but is done all over the world and has been done since time began. Or another option is to set up a more formal structure like a trust, which is really one of the most ingenious devices of English common law, in that it creates this magic where it separates legal ownership from beneficial ownership. And what I mean by that is the legal owners, the people who are registered on the title, are listed as other trustees, but the people who actually benefit from the assets are a different group of people altogether, the beneficiaries, and their names are kept private. And in fact, they don't even have, in many cases, don't even have proprietary rights. Mm-hmm. So they themselves can't necessarily access the assets. So a trust, again, the traditional common law trust has an inherent asset protection benefit and features. But what's happened over the years is those features have been enhanced in different jurisdictions through statutory modifications to make those trusts even more robust. And the reason they need to be more robust or have been made more robust is because there are other laws competing with trust law to enable creditors or other threats to access property and trusts. So certain jurisdictions have shortened limitation periods, have imposed firewalls, and enacted a whole bunch of other features to enhance the asset protection benefits of trusts.
So what is special about New Zealand, though? What can we offer that other jurisdictions can't?
Well, in terms of asset protection, I'd suggest probably nothing more than what the traditional common law trust can provide. But that's not a pure asset protection jurisdiction. Mm. So some jurisdictions are really pure asset protection jurisdictions. Nevis, yeah. The Cook Islands are set up. New Zealand doesn't offer anything more, or doesn't even offer as much protection as those jurisdictions. But what it does provide, I think, is first of all those inherent features in existing English common law trusts anyway, but also it provides a level of legitimacy and substance and governance which possibly
that's the key.
Maybe less well accepted in other jurisdictions.
Yeah, I think that's the key. If you look at trusts in New Zealand, the Ministry of Justice estimates there's between 300,000 and 500,000 trusts in New Zealand, which means up to 10% of the population has a trust or has access to a trust. New Zealanders, in my experience, get trusts. I say I work for a trust company, everybody knows what I do. Mm. That doesn't happen around the world. Mm. And I think when it comes to making the asset protection mechanism of a trust work, it has to have been administered properly. Mm. The governance part has to have been done correctly, because if you've administered with the best will of the world, with the nicest wording in that trust, if it has been administered incorrectly or as if it is the asset of the person who has got divorced, who has been made bankrupt, who is being sued, the court is going to ride roughshod over it or is going to ignore the asset protectionness of it. Or if the asset is in a jurisdiction which recognises or doesn't recognise trusts and is called on the trust deed or the way it has been administered, it's just going to ignore it unless it has been administered properly, or even sometimes even despite it having been administered properly. So I think to make the asset protection trust work, it needs to be set up in the right jurisdiction, administered in the right way, and the asset needs to be in a jurisdiction that it all needs to fall into place to make the asset protection mechanism work. I think it's a lot of things that need to go right. And the way that I've always thought about it is the asset protection part of the trust is like a seatbelt, that it will protect you in most crashes. And it's that protection as exactly at the asset protection, because we've had a situation where we've had assets in trust and the asset itself was in a jurisdiction that didn't recognise trusts. Mm. So it doesn't recognise the trust ownership, so they were seized. And there's nothing you can do to enforce the trust.
Yeah, I think that's right. An asset protection structure is only as strong as its weakest link. And I think it's not only a matter of putting in place a really good trust deed around the assets, but you've got to have the governance to support the integrity of the structure. And then you've also got to think about where the assets are. And in many cases, if you've got real assets, you often don't have much ability to re-custody those assets in your own jurisdiction. And so there's always going to be a bit of risk around real assets in an asset protection structure. Yeah. But certainly if you've got liquid assets, it gets a bit easier because you can re-custody those.
Definitely.
and bring them into a either the same jurisdiction as a trust or at least one which will recognise the trust.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it depends on the type of asset as well. I think you're absolutely right there. So, Henry, we've talked today about New Zealand in the context of tax. We've talked about tax neutrality, tax optimization, and levelling the playing field. We've talked about privacy in the context of what it means to the clients and the external threats to an individual's privacy, that privacy does not mean wrongdoing. There are legitimate reasons that a person requires privacy. And we've talked about privacy in terms of personal data. We've also talked about asset protection and why New Zealand, although it's not a prime asset protection jurisdiction, it still offers a lot when it comes to asset protection and trusts. So next time we'll pick up in our next episode with regards to the regulatory environment, corruption, political and economic stability, and how New Zealand measures up on the worldwide stage on whether or not it's glamorous enough for some of our clients. Anything you wanted to add to that, Henry?
Thanks for the opportunity and to all those that have tuned in, and looking forward to continuing the discussion.
So thanks everyone for listening. Do reach out to either Henry or I on LinkedIn or via our company website if you've got any feedback or any further questions, and look forward to talking to you next time.